Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. In today's case, we're diving into one of Ireland's most enduring mysteries. The disappearance of Alida Lidi Kaspersma. It's a case that's lingered over the town of Kenmare, County Kerry for over four decades. Lidi was a 26-year-old Dutch woman who loved exploring the world. Born on the 8th of March, 1952 in the Netherlands, Lidi was the youngest of three sisters. Her family moved around a bit, settling in the province of Overijssel, where her father, Gutse, became well known as a choir conductor and music teacher. Lidi was described as adventurous and independent, a bit of a free spirit. She had a passion for travel and a heart for helping others. Fluent in Dutch, English, French and German, she didn't just limit herself to one place. Over the years, Lidi pursued various roles that allowed her to combine her love of travel and helping others. Initially, she began training as a psychiatric nurse in the Netherlands. But after 3 months, she decided to drop out, feeling it just wasn't the right path for her. Shortly afterwards, she transitioned to working as a kindergarten teacher, where her love for children and nurturing nature found a perfect outlet. This role marked the beginning of her journey into caregiving, which would later take her abroad. She worked as a kindergarten teacher in the Netherlands, using her nurturing nature to support young children. Her journey then took her across the globe to Texas, where she worked also as a nanny, providing care and guidance to children of a local family. Later, she moved to Germany and took on the role of a caregiver to the elderly, offering companionship and assistance to those in need. These roles reflected her compassionate and resilient character, and she often wrote home about the meaningful connections she made in each place. Lidi was known for her love of children and animals, and those who knew her often spoke of her kindness and enthusiasm for life. Her family described her as a bit of a hippie girl, always chasing new experiences. Despite her wanderlust, Lidi was thoughtful and reliable, someone who kept in touch no matter where her travels took her in the world. As a child, Lidi showed a natural curiosity about the world around her. Growing up in a musical household, she developed a love for singing and often accompanied her father to choir practices. Her close-knit family cherished their time together. With Lidi's adventurous nature balanced by her parents' protective instincts. Lidi's father was a strong influence, instilling in her a sense of compassion and resilience. She was a good student, excelling in languages and showing a knack for storytelling and creative writing. As Lidi grew older, she embraced the freedom of travel. Her journey began with small trips around the Netherlands. But as she gained confidence, she started venturing further afield. Her work with children in different countries reflected, as I said, her nurturing nature, and her letters home were filled with stories of the people she'd met and the places she'd visited. Lidi's sisters recall her being both spontaneous and practical, a dreamer, yes, but someone who always had a plan. This spirit of adventure and love of connection would eventually lead her to Ireland, where she planned to explore the landscapes and immerse herself in the culture. In February 1978, she embarked on this trip that took her from Dublin to Mayo, to Galway, to Kerry, to Limerick and to Cork. So she travelled to all the major places, you could say, in the south. But little did anyone know this journey would ultimately be the beginning of a chain of events that are still a mystery to this day, leaving a void in the lives of those who loved her. As Lidi was living her adventurous life, travelling and exploring new places, fate brought her into the path of Nicholas Nick Wheatley. Now, Nick was a 29-year-old Englishman, originally from London, and he had a bit of a complicated past. He had been married, but was recently separated from his wife, with whom he had a young daughter. Nick was known as a bit of a dreamer, a poet, with a penchant for living off the beaten track. By the time he met Leedy, he was in a period of, I suppose, transition, trying to figure out his next steps after his marriage had ended. So the two met during a ferry crossing from Dublin to Holyhead as Leedy began her trip home. Leedy had been travelling, as I said, through Ireland, exploring the countryside, and she was on her way back to the Netherlands when she met Nick on the ferry. She'd spent some time soaking up the rugged landscapes and the local culture, but it was time for her to move on. On that ferry crossing from Dublin to Holyhead in early 1978, Leedy noticed a man travelling with a dog and carrying a typewriter in his suitcase. That man, as I said, was Nick Wheatley. Now, Nick had a poetic soul and was, as I said, liked to live somewhat of a nomadic lifestyle. The two struck up a conversation during the journey, drawn together by their shared sense of adventure and their curiosity about the world. Nick was trying to navigate life after his recent separation from his wife, and he was figuring out what his next steps were going to be. He would later say that they had a good conversation on the ferry and that she was great fun. He said they both laughed. He said he was 29 at the time and coming out of a 6-year marriage, and he also had a young daughter. You'd wonder, was Leedy just a distraction from the breakdown of his marriage and no more than that, looking back in hindsight. So after arriving in Holyhead, Leedy and Nick decided to continue their journey together. They took the train from Holyhead to London, spending more time getting to know each other. Leedy planned to continue on to Dover to catch a ferry back to the Netherlands. But something from that chance meeting must have lingered, because on the 27th of February 1978, she returned to London. The two reconnected, and it was then that their relationship truly began to develop. The spark that had ignited on the ferry had appeared to have stayed with both of them. Nick would then travel to visit Leedy in the Netherlands. After spending some time together, they decided to return to Ireland. The two shared a love of simplicity and freedom. They didn't have grand plans or ambitions. Instead, they seemed content to live day to day, moving from place to place as the mood struck them. Perhaps it was the allure of the rugged landscape or just a sense of escape. Whatever the reason, they made their way back to the southwest of Ireland by May of 1978 in their newly bought second-hand Opel Record estate, which they bought for 800 marks. Before that, they travelled to Bourne, where Nick met with Leedy's family. To them, it seemed like their relationship was developing seriously and fairly quickly. Leedy's family recalled Nick as a quiet and somewhat reserved, but polite, seemingly genuine in his affection for Leedy. While there, Leedy's father gave her a Bible. The gesture was not taken in the spirit I'm assuming it was meant to have been taken. Leedy got angry and threw the Bible to one side. Now, Leedy's family, they were quite religious. Her father taught music for the Dutch Reformist Church. Her parents had already shown their disapproval about a previous relationship Leedy had with a Catholic man. But Leedy did not appear to share her parents' deep religious views. Nick would later be quoted as allegedly saying that it was at this point doubts about their relationship started to enter into his head. Despite any reservations Nick said he was having, the move to Kerry happened. On the 12th of May 1978, they boarded the ferry from Ostend to Dover. When they disembarked, they travelled to Cornwall and visited Nick's parents. Then on the 19th of May, they got on a ferry from Holyhead to Dublin. The ferry, you could say, where they had first encountered each other, only, you could say, a few short months earlier. Nick again spoke about how by now he was really starting to notice how different they were, stating that Leedy was very political, with strong left-wing views, whereas he had no political views and was a lot more laid back in his approach to life. Leedy would write several letters home to her parents while on their travels, so whatever happened over the Bible incident did not appear to have any long-term consequences for the relationship between her and her parents. On arrival in Dublin, they stayed with friends of Nick's, Raphael and Pauline Skerritt, in Castleknock. Nick had previously worked for them as a tree surgeon. Leedy, while in Dublin, opened a new Irish bank account with the Allied Irish Bank, or AIB as we call it, and lodged £10 into the account, which was a nice little bit of money back in the late 70s. They bought a tent, sorted through their stuff, leaving some belongings at the skirts, and then on the 28th of May, they left Dublin. Destination, Kerry. Initially, they stayed with another friend of Nick's, pitching a tent on his land. They would stay there for a few weeks while Nick made some money helping bale hay before moving on. They settled in Kenmare, County Kerry, a small but charming town that had, by the 1970s, become a bit of a gathering spot for young travellers, those, I suppose, seeking a more rustic, off-the-grid lifestyle. They pitched their tent on the lands of Andrew and Sissy Woods at a place called Erneen. This was about 9 kilometres from Kenmare town. The Woods were also friends of Nick's, and they didn't seem to mind the couple setting up camp on their property. Now, Nick did appear to have a lot of friends living in Ireland. Leedy and Nick lived simply during those weeks. They had minimal belongings, and their lifestyle was very much in tune with nature. Locals who met them described them as a quiet, seemingly happy couple, who mostly kept to themselves. While Nick took some odd jobs in the area, Leedy enjoyed the freedom of wandering the countryside and writing letters back home. In her letters, she described the beauty of the area, mentioning how much she enjoyed the peacefulness and the simplicity of life there. Leedy seemed to be soaking in the experience, even as underlying tensions were beginning to build between her and Nick. The couple's relationship began to show visible strain as Nick became increasingly preoccupied with thoughts of leaving Kenmare, feeling that he and Leedy were simply too different as people. According to Nick himself, the realization was that they fundamentally had different outlooks and lifestyles. As the weeks went on, Nick grew more vocal about wanting to leave Kenmare and go back to Dublin to stay with his friends. At some point, he brought up the subject directly to Leedy, expressing his need to return and his desire to reconnect with his family back in England. According to reports, Nick was the one who made the decision to end the relationship. He told Leedy that he planned to return to Dublin to stay with friends. Initially, Leedy refused to accept this. She struggled with the reality of the breakup and expressed her reluctance to let go. Seeing that she was finding it hard to come to terms with this decision, Nick wrote her a note explicitly stating that the relationship was over. This seemed to be the turning point, and from that moment on, Leedy's demeanour changed. As I said, at first she didn't want to accept this decision. But friends and locals who saw them during this time period noted that she seemed visibly upset and struggled to come to terms with the breakup. However, after getting the note and as the days passed, it appears that she slowly began to accept the reality of the situation. Leedy's sisters would later explain that this reaction was typical of her. She'd initially resisted change, but would eventually accept it when it became inevitable. Those who observed them noted Leedy remained outwardly calm after that period. But friends of the couple later recalled that she seemed more introspective in the days that followed. In a show of acceptance, Leedy reportedly helped Nick organise his belongings and even prepared his clothes for travel. By this stage, there was no obvious tension between them. But there was a notable sense of sadness kind of hanging over the camp. Nick appeared somewhat distant, as if already mentally preparing himself to leave. To the locals who saw them, there was an air of quiet resignation, as if both of them knew that their relationship had reached its natural conclusion. According to those who interacted with them during this period, Nick made it clear that he planned to leave Kenmare and go back to Dublin, where he had stayed with friends before. Leedy, on the other hand, seemed more settled and had even made plans to move into a room at the Woods' house once Nick left. She discussed this arrangement with Woods, indicating that she intended to stay in the area and make a life for herself independently. Leedy's letters to her family remained optimistic, filled with anecdotes about her walks, the friendly locals, and the stunning natural beauty surrounding her. There was no indication that she felt threatened or uneasy. Even as Nick prepared to leave, Leedy seemed focused on finding her own way forward in Ireland. Now, this takes us to the 2nd of July, 1978. What happened next remains one of the most baffling mysteries in Irish true crime history. On the morning of Monday, the 2nd of July, 1978, Leedy and Nick left the Woods property and drove into Kenmare in Nick's Opel Rekord estate car. The reason for going to town was, according to Nick, to pick up some supplies ahead of his planned journey to Dublin the following day. While in Kenmare, Leedy was seen in a local coffee shop by a member of the public, who later recalled that she seemed uneasy and unsettled. She was wearing a blue and white t-shirt, a cream woolen cardigan, brown cord trousers and three-quarter length boots, and she also had her brown handbag with her. This would be the final confirmed sighting of her by anyone other than Nick. According to Nick, they left Kenmare in or around 3:45 and drove on to Glengariff, then on towards their campsite at Airneen. The area they were in, as I said, was very rugged and mountainous. Just a few kilometres from the Woods property, Leedy allegedly told Nick, this is all according to Nick, we obviously don't have Leedy's side of the story, so everything I'm telling you is from his point of view. So Leedy allegedly told Nick to stop the car and she would get out. He assumed she was just going to go for a walk through some of the fields back to the campsite. He said she looked him in the eyes and she gave him a big kiss on the lips before getting out of the car and walking back down the lane they had just driven up. That stretch of road was bordered by rugged terrain, thick hedgerows, open fields and very little foot traffic or nearby housing, so it was very isolated. He said this was the last time he saw Leedy. Nick drove back to the Woods' house, arriving, he said, around 4:30 p.m. Nick didn't wear a watch, so it was all surmising, expecting Leedy to appear soon afterwards. When she failed to appear after an hour, he said he did get a little bit concerned, and he was really starting to worry by nightfall. That night, he headed back into Kenmare. He went around to all the various pubs, looking to see if she was in any of them. Obviously, she wasn't. He checked with some friends to see had she gone to stay with them, but there was still no sign of Leedy. He said at this point, he just assumed she was staying somewhere else, like a B&B or something. Now, Nick was supposed to head to Dublin the following day, but it appears from some of the stuff I read that he stayed around the area for a little bit longer, a few days longer, and then that he headed off to Dublin as planned a few days later, despite the fact that there was still no sign of Leedy. And there's nothing to say, well, actually, he didn't report her missing at this stage either. Now, while in Dublin, I read in some areas that his ex-wife and his daughter came to visit him. He would later say, I was a young man in my 20s and very naive, holding out hope that maybe, maybe, just maybe, there might be a chance that we could get back together. This all seems very strange to me, that this is what he's thinking about, whether he's in his 20s or not, when his latest girlfriend is missing. And he was technically the last person to see her. I just find that very strange. Apparently then, after an unspecified period of time, Nick rang the Woods to see if Leedy had returned. That's another thing I find strange. Sorry, now I keep interrupting. Did they not wonder where she was when she didn't return with Nick and then continued to be absent from that day forward? Was nobody worried about her whereabouts at all? I mean, now, Leedy was last seen that day, the 2nd of July, walking away from the car. She reportedly only had about 80 pence in her bag. Her passport was back at the Woods house, so she wasn't going to be leaving the country. Actually, most of her belongings that she would have needed if she was leaving were at the Woods house, because she was going to be moving in there. She was moving into one of their rooms, as I said. So along with her passport, her glasses were back there. She was wearing contact lenses that day, and they would have only lasted for the day. And obviously they would have had to come out that night, and her cleaning kit as well was back at the house. You know, so Her sister did say that she would not have been able to see without either her contact lenses or her glasses. And speaking of her sister, back in the Netherlands, Lidie's family had no idea she was missing. Nobody had told them. She was known, though, to keep in regular touch, as you knew, as I told you, usually sending letters or postcards, and always did so during her travels. When no contact came, concern began to grow. Lidie's mother's 60th birthday fell on July the 17th, 1978. And the silence that came from Lidie on that most important occasion was deeply out of character for her. Her parents and her siblings were growing increasingly uneasy. Her mother sent a telegram addressed to Lidie at the Woods' home in Kemmare, and the message just simply read, "Where is Lidie? We are uneasy." By that stage, she had already been missing for over 2 weeks. It was not until the 25th of July, 1978, 23 days after she was last seen, that Nick Wheatley returned to Kenmare. Upon arriving and finding no trace of Lidie, he finally went to the Garda station in Kenmare to report her missing. I mean, this delay would significantly hinder any potential early stage investigation. When questioned by the Gardaí, Nick repeated the account he would later give to the press that Lidie had asked to be let out of the car on the 2nd of July, kissed him and walked away down the road. He claimed he believed she needed time alone and he had no reason to suspect anything was wrong. Gardaí took his statement, but they faced an uphill battle. With 3 weeks of lost time, they had no fresh leads, no active scene to examine and no immediate witnesses. The road where she had been last seen was a rural stretch with little traffic. Any trace of her movements, footprints, discarded items, signs of a struggle would have been lost to time and weather. When Nick finally did report Lidie missing on the 25th of July, Gardaí in Kenmare opened an official missing persons file. But they are, as I said, already 3 weeks behind. The delay created immediate obstacles. There was no active scene, no fresh trail to follow, and no sign of Lidie or of what had happened to her in the remote area where she was last seen. Officers conducted interviews with locals and began searching the surrounding terrain, focusing on the stretch of mountain road where Nick claimed he dropped her off. The road itself was narrow and flanked with thick vegetation, boggy ground and low stone walls. The terrain between Erneen and Kenmare, as I said, was rural, hilly and lightly trafficked, an area where someone could, in theory, vanish without being noticed. But this search produced nothing. Lidie's belongings were still in her tent, and her passport and her glasses and her contact lenses were all back where she'd left them. As I said, she'd worn the contacts daily and considered glasses as an essential. There was no way she would have been able to see properly without them, her sister Nellie said. Even if she wanted to disappear, she would not go anywhere without her passport or her glasses. There was also the question of money. Lidie, as I said, had only 80 pence in her possession at the time she vanished. And the £10 that she had recently deposited into the AIB bank was never touched. Despite the lack of physical clues, Gardaí tried to reconstruct her last movements. But they found no one other than Nick who had seen her after she left the cafe in Kenmare. The car she travelled in, Nick's Opel Rekord Estate, was also no longer available for examination. Its whereabouts were unknown. It had apparently either been sold or scrapped before the Gardaí even began looking for it. The investigation quickly came to centre on Nick Wheatley. He was the last person to see Lidie alive. He admitted they had recently split up. He admitted she had been emotional, and yet he had waited more than 3 weeks to say anything. Nick was interviewed at length by Gardaí. He was not placed under arrest, but his story was treated with scepticism. He told Gardaí that when Lidie asked to get out of the car, he saw it as a sign that she just needed space. "I just thought she wanted time on her own," he said later. "She got out of the car, she kissed me and started walking back down the road. I never saw her again." The Kaspersma family was devastated. Lidie's two older sisters, Tinka and Nellie, and her brother-in-law, Hans, travelled to Ireland in 1979 to speak to the Gardaí and to investigate for themselves. They met resistance. We felt shut out, Hans told the Irish Independent. People who knew Nick would not speak to us. One of them, the Woods family, would not even allow us onto the land where Leedy had been staying. That was deeply suspicious. The family never believed that Leedy had simply walked away. Her father said plainly, she was not the kind of girl who would disappear. She would never do that to us. Something terrible happened to her. Her sister Tinka echoed this sentiment decades later in a Dutch interview. At first we hoped she was just travelling, but as time passed we knew. Someone did something to her. I am convinced of that. Nick Wheatley, for his part, maintained his version of events and denied any wrongdoing. In a rare interview with journalist Barry Cummings for his Without Trace book, Nick said, I think there are three possibilities. She could have gone off with someone. She could have had an accident. Or she could have taken her own life. The possibility that someone harmed her, well, I try not to think about that, but it's there. His insistence that Leedy may have chosen to disappear of her own accord was always flatly rejected by her family. She would never leave without saying goodbye, Nelly said. She always stayed in contact. Always. A postcard, a letter, a phone call. She never just vanished. In autumn of 1978, the Garda investigation appeared to stall. There were no leads, no body, no crime scene, and no witnesses beyond Nick. No formal suspects were named, but quietly, investigators from the Dublin Murder Squad were sent to Kerry in early 1979 to conduct a deeper inquiry. An unusual move that hinted at the direction Gardaí were now taking it. They were treating it as a possible homicide. But there were still no arrests, no charges, no explanation. In March 1979, nearly 8 months after Leedy vanished, a full-scale search was finally launched in the mountains around Kenmare. Kerry Mountain Rescue joined the effort. Volunteers and Gardaí swept the hills, forests and fields near Éireann using search dogs and line searches. But nothing was found. By the end of the 70s, Leedy Caspar Smal's disappearance had faded from the headlines, but it never faded from the minds of her family or those closest to her. Despite the initial Garda investigation, the involvement of the murder squad and the extensive land searches, no answers emerged. No body was found and no charges were brought. Nick Wheatley remained the last known person to see her alive and suspicion lingered. Though Gardaí never publicly named him a suspect, they continued to revisit the case in the background, quietly gathering what little information they could over the years. According to reports from the time, Nick Wheatley left Ireland shortly after Leedy's disappearance, and he travelled to the Lebanon, where he took a job establishing an English language school there. His decision to move to the Lebanon at the time, a country with no extradition treaty with Ireland, had drawn scrutiny, really. It effectively placed him outside the reach of the Gardaí should further questions arise. He left the country not long after she vanished, said Hans, Leedy's brother-in-law. And he chose a country where Gardaí couldn't bring him back. That tells you something. In later years, Nick returned to England, where he reportedly resumed a quiet life. Gardaí re-interviewed him in the early 2000s during a cold case review. According to journalist Barry Cummins, who spoke with Nick during research for his book Without Trace, Wheatley repeated the same story, that Leedy got out of the car of her own free will and walked away. He claimed to be haunted by her disappearance, but continued to suggest it was possible she had chosen to vanish. But Leedy's family never accepted that theory. Leedy did not just walk off into the mountains and disappear, her sister Nelly said. She left her things. She left her passport. She left her glasses. She couldn't have gone anywhere without them. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, Leedy's parents maintained an enormous archive of correspondence, clippings, photos and police records related to the case. Her father, who lived into his 90s, never gave up hope of finding out what had happened to his daughter. It was the first thing he thought of every morning, Tinka later said, and the last thing at night. He kept every letter, every note from the Gardaí. He wanted answers. Leedy's sisters and brother-in-law returned to Ireland several times over the decades, searching for fresh information, but progress was painfully slow. In 1999, the case gained renewed attention with Barry Cummins' book, which included Leedy's story. The book documented some of Ireland's most baffling missing person cases. The chapter sparked a new interest in the case and was one of the first to publicly explore the idea that Leedy's disappearance may not have been accidental. The family continued to hope that someone, perhaps a former local or a friend of Nick's, would finally come forward. Then, in 2013, there was a flicker of possibility. A Facebook page dedicated to Leedy's memory received a direct message from a man claiming that his father, now dying, had something to reveal about Leedy's disappearance. The message urged the family to make contact quickly, suggesting that the man's father had carried a secret for years and wanted to speak before it was too late. Gardaí were alerted and an investigation was opened into the message. But before contact could be made, the man's father died. Whatever information he may have held, if any, went with him to the grave. For Leedy's family, it was another cruel false start. "We had hope for a moment," said Nelly, "but again, it slipped away." In 2016, the Kaspersma family issued what they called their final appeal to the Irish public. Speaking to the Irish Independent and the Belfast Telegraph, they begged for anyone with knowledge to come forward. "We just want closure to this nightmare," Hans said. "We don't want revenge. We just want to know what happened." Tinka, Leedy's sister, added, "We believe someone in Kenmare knows. They may not have spoken then, but people change. Maybe someone has a conscience now. Please, just tell us what you know." In the years that followed, the case remained open in both Ireland and the Netherlands. Leedy is still listed as a missing person by Dutch authorities and her DNA is on file for potential future matches. In 2021, Tinka gave a rare interview to the Dutch broadcaster RTV Oost. Now in her 70s, she acknowledged that the family had long accepted that Leedy was likely no longer alive. But that didn't stop her from hoping for the truth. "I have no illusion that she is still living," Tinka said. "But I hope that before I die, someone will say what happened. Someone who knows, even if it's small, just so we can finally lay her to rest." Leedy's disappearance left an unhealable fracture in her family, one that only deepened with time. Her mother, like her father, never gave up hope of learning the truth. She lived for decades with uncertainty, marking each of Leedy's birthdays and anniversaries without any closure. Her daughters later said that the loss aged her and changed her irreversibly. She died before 2006, having never received any answers about what became of her youngest child. By that time, both parents were gone. In 2006, under Dutch law and in accordance with standard procedures for prolonged disappearances, Leedy Kaspersma was officially declared deceased, 28 years after she was last seen on a mountain road outside Kenmare. The declaration was legal, not emotional. For the family, it was simply a necessary formality to settle her estate. It brought no comfort, no closure. Her sister Tinka later told Dutch media, "We didn't do it because we gave up hope. We did it because the law required it. But for us, she was gone from the moment she didn't come home." Nick has never been charged with any crime in connection to Leedy's disappearance and has constantly denied any wrongdoing. As of the most recent reports, Nick Wheatley is believed to be still living in the UK. He has not spoken publicly about the case in recent years. It's hard to imagine what it's like for a family to live for nearly five decades with no answers, No body, no grave, no closure, just silence and the weight of not knowing. Lady Kaspersma was a real person, a daughter, a sister-in-law, a kind, open-hearted woman who loved children, languages, travel, and the simple beauty of life. She wasn't reckless, she wasn't naive, and she didn't just wander off. Something happened to her on that mountain road outside Kenmare on the 2nd of July 1978, and someone knows what that is. Her family have never asked for revenge, only the truth. So if you're listening to this and you were living in the Kerry area at the time, if you were one of the people who passed her in Kenmare that day, if you heard something in the weeks or months after that didn't sit right with you, even if it felt like a little bit of gossip or a passing remark, please say something. It's never too late. You can contact the Gardaí confidentially by calling Kenmare Garda Station on 353-64-664-1177 or reach out through the Garda Missing Persons Bureau at 353-1666-2615. Alternatively, you can share the information through the Garda Confidential line at 1-800-666-111. That's free phone in Ireland. Or go to the Garda website, www.garda.ie, and navigate to the missing persons section. Even the smallest detail, something you've carried for years, it could be the key to helping a grieving family finally find peace. Because silence doesn't protect the innocent, and Leedy deserves the truth. So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto-download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.